Well, a big thank you to the orchestra and to our intergenerational choir for leading us this morning. It's great to have you here for this Christmas celebration Sunday today. And I want to start the sermon with a bit of an admission to you. I was a terrible cook. Or maybe it would be better to say I was a great non-cook. I could boil water and I could put bread in the toaster. And that was about the extent of my cooking skills. But over the last few years, that has actually changed to the point that this past Thanksgiving, I actually made the Thanksgiving dinner for our family. Now, that sounds a whole lot more impressive than it actually was. I, you know, didn't make the whole bird or anything, but you know, made the different things. And actually, the most impressive accomplishment for me was the timing. I actually timed them all to be done at about the same time, which, you know, if you're a cook, you know that maybe that's like the masterful part of the whole thing. And so I nailed it this year anyway. You might wonder, what made the change? I mean, how did I go from a non-cook to, not a great one, but at least a passable one? I'm going to come back to that in a little bit. But it leads to kind of a broader question for us to consider, and that is, what causes a person to change in any way? I mean, how do you go from not having a certain quality to then growing in that quality? How do you go from lacking a particular skill to then having that skill? What causes that kind of growth? A number of years ago, I came across a comic strip, actually, Dennis the Menace, some of you will know and appreciate, and it kind of illustrated this question a little bit for us. So Dennis is playing, and his frequent antagonist, Margaret, shows up. And she says, Dennis, I've been working on an image makeover for you. First, a new hairstyle. Then, a fashionably trendy wardrobe. Add a generous application of some cologne. And finally, an attitude adjustment toward a certain redhead. And she says, well, what do you think? And he says, well, there's just one thing that I would leave out. Me. And Margaret walks away, and she sighs and thinks, he looked so good on paper. Well, I'm, of course, not interested primarily on this Christmas celebration Sunday on fashion makeovers or learning to cook, but I'm thinking about spiritual change. What is it that makes spiritual change possible in your life or mine? And Jesus was the master at making that happen. And so I want to take us to a particular story of Jesus this morning in Mark chapter 2. And I would welcome you to turn there with me in either the Pew Bibles or your own Bible or on your device. But I encourage you to turn to Mark 2. We want to see how Jesus does it. So we're in this Advent Christmas series called The New Kid in Town. Of course, Jesus, you're in church, so you know who the new kid in town is that we're thinking of. We're thinking of Jesus. He was that new kid that came in and upended the world as it was at the time. And we want to understand a little bit of how he did it. And so throughout this series, we're actually kind of fast-forwarding past the Christmas story. And we're looking at what Jesus himself, what adult Jesus said about why he came. You know, why did he come all those years earlier in Bethlehem as a baby? Why did he come? And we're looking at how he describes it for us. And so Mark chapter 2 is where we pick it up this morning, verse 13. It says, once again, Jesus went out beside the lake. A large crowd came to him, and he began to teach them. As he walked along, he saw Levi, son of Alphaeus, sitting at the tax collector's booth. Follow me, Jesus told him. And Levi got up and followed him. While Jesus was having dinner at Levi's house, many tax collectors and sinners were eating with him and his disciples, for there were many who followed him. When the teachers of the law, who were Pharisees, saw him eating with the sinners and tax collectors, they asked his disciples, why does he eat with tax collectors and sinners? On hearing this, Jesus said to them, it is not the healthy who need a doctor, but the sick. I have not come to call the righteous, but sinners. He's not come for the righteous. He's come for sinners. Are you a sinner? Has he come for you? Well, let's dive into this story a little bit. So it helps us to understand a few of the key groups that are part of this story. First of all, we've got Levi and a whole other group of tax collectors like Levi. And so let's understand who these people were. They would have been in that context, in that place and time, they would have been Jewish men who had bought contracts from the occupying Roman government to collect taxes and customs and tolls. So, tax collectors. Now, if you take the way the average person feels about the IRS today, and you multiply it, let's say by a factor of 10, then you can begin to understand how tax collectors of that day were viewed. Comparisons that I found as I was researching for this sermon to tax collectors included kind of modern day things would be a drug lord, a Marxist, a racist, or a corrupt politician backing terrorists. That's how tax collectors were viewed. They were considered to be traitors because they worked for the Romans. They were considered to be extortionists, so they would bring in all kinds of money through the way the system worked. It was said in some sources that they could set up tax collection booths wherever they wanted, whenever they wanted. So they could just kind of bring their books, sit down at a table, open up, and anybody passing by had to pay their taxes. And they were the final word on how much people owed. There was no hotline to call. You didn't talk to your CPA to confirm the number. The tax collector said, this is what you owed. You had to pay with the power of the Roman government behind them. And so, as you can imagine, there's all kinds of room for corruption there. Because the tax collector is only responsible to pay in a certain amount to the government and anything else they can keep. And so it was common to take far more than was actually required to pay the tax, and the collector himself would keep it. So, lucrative financially, yes. But of course, there was a cost to this windfall, and that was that these men were social outcasts. I mean, you would, in that day, you would rather have a thief come and rob you in your house than have a tax collector show up. Religious Jews like the Pharisees viewed tax collectors as ceremonially unclean. They were alienated from God. They were not allowed in synagogues. They were not allowed to testify in court because, you know, who can trust a tax collector? Rabbis, who generally frowned on lying, gave the average person permission to lie if it would hinder the work of a tax collector. Gives you a picture of who these people were. Then we come to the Pharisees. And, of course, chances are good you know the term Pharisee, even if you don't know the biblical usage of Pharisee, because we think of Pharisees as people who are very legalistic and focused on the rules and ultimately are hypocritical, and they come by that honestly. But, I mean, they started out with very good motives. I mean, Pharisees were very concerned about following the Jewish laws. They wanted to keep the law as closely as possible. The name Pharisee literally means separatist because they wanted to separate themselves from sin of any kind. And so what happened over time is they thought, well, we want to obey the law at all times and we want to separate ourselves from sin. So, if here's the line, between, like, over here is sinning and this is not sinning. Well, then we need a fence to push us back even further, to keep us further away from sin. And so they had this thing called the tradition of the elders that was their kind of interpretation and application of the law that built up over time to protect them, to keep them pure. And they gave these traditions the same authority as their laws, as their scriptures. Well, they came to believe that God's grace was really only extended to essentially the healthy, the wealthy, and the wise. And everybody else was a sinner. So we have tax collectors and, as Mark describes it, other sinners, these people who did not follow the law, at least not as devoutly as the Pharisees tried to. And then we have the Pharisees, and you can see we've got kind of a combustible mix here. And then we have Jesus. Jesus coming into the story and Jesus coming into the world with a whole different approach. I might summarize Jesus' approach this way. Jesus came to pursue the unholy and to infect them with holy love. See, the Pharisees, they were afraid of being contaminated by sinners. They thought that sinners should clean themselves up before they come. I mean, if you want to come to God, then get your act together and come to God. It's not God's job to chase after sinful people. Of course, Jesus wasn't concerned about being contaminated by sin. You might say he wanted to contaminate sinners with his holiness. And we see how he does that with Levi. You know, it's possible that Levi was following Jesus around with his tax records. Because, you know, where Jesus was, there was a crowd. So, you know, keep the tax books. Jesus stops the crowd, starts to talk. Well, let's open up the books and get people as they're coming by. But, of course, from a distance, he would have heard what Jesus was saying as he was exploiting people. Until that fateful day that Jesus approaches him and invites this tax collector, Levi, to be his disciple. He says, follow me, learn from me, become like me. And then you'll be qualified to spread my message and my way of life to others. You have to wonder what the other disciples who were also part of this whole thing thought. I mean, chances are good that these other disciples had been cheated by Levi at some point. And now, oh my word, Jesus is inviting one of them into the circle. How could he do that? It would have been hard for them probably to love and accept this person that Jesus is bringing in, this outcast. And then, of course, Jesus takes it a step further. He goes and he actually eats at this tax collector's house, and there are other tax collectors and sinners there with him. And I mean, even just to eat with them was a sign of friendship and respect and acceptance. Oh yes, Jesus' approach was very different than the Pharisees, wasn't it? Rather than making Levi come to him first, rather than making him change first, Jesus goes to him, accepting him as he is. I mean, it's natural for us to think, it's natural for us to think that if you want to be accepted, then you need to do something to be acceptable. You have to believe a certain way, think a certain way, act a certain way, speak a certain way, look a certain way to be acceptable. And even in relationship with God, and I've heard this sentiment expressed by people at times, if you're going to come to God, then I've got to get myself straightened out first, and then I'll come. But the message of the Bible, of course, is that Jesus came pursuing us to help us get straightened out rather than waiting for us to straighten ourselves out. He came for us. I love the way 19th century British poet Francis Thompson described Jesus. He called him the Hound of Heaven. Isn't that an interesting picture? Just a line from the poem says, "He comes after us with unhurrying chase and unperturbed pace, deliberate speed and majestic urgency." The Hound of Heaven. Later on, Paul, follower of Jesus, would write to Christians in Rome this way. He said, "You see, at just the right time, God demonstrated his own love for us in this. When we were still powerless, while we were still sinners, Christ died for us." Why would he do that? Why would Jesus come pursuing us? Why would he be the Hound of Heaven coming after us? Ungodly people, powerless people, sinful people. I think at least one answer to that is that Jesus focuses more on our potential than he does on our present. He focuses more on our potential than he does our present. Usually, potential students of a Jewish rabbi in the first century, they would approach the rabbi and kind of promote themselves to the rabbi as, you know, "I think I could be a great student for you." And it was kind of a high achievement to have a rabbi agree with you that, yes, actually, you could be a good student for me, and you could actually learn and then perpetuate my ways in the world. And yet Jesus, again, his approach is so different. He doesn't wait for people to come to him and, you know, audition for the part of disciple. He goes to them. He seeks them, and he picks some of the most unlikely people, like Levi. And his message to Levi when he says, "Follow me," is, in a sense, him saying, "I see in you the potential to become like me." He wasn't just looking at the present reality, Matthew with his tax books. He was looking at his potential. And of course, he learned, you ask, where did he learn an approach like that? Well, he learned it from God the Father. You know, God the Father, who millennia before saw this little group of people, Israel, you know, a family that became a clan, that became tribes, that became a nation, and he said, "These are going to be my people, and I'm going to do something unique in the world through them." And God the Father saw nobodies by human standards with names that you know today, Mary and Joseph. Nobodies in that world, in that day. And he said, "I'm going to make these people the parents of the divine." And he saw shepherds who were outcasts in that day, and he said, "I'm going to make you messengers of the divine." This is what God does. This is what Jesus learned to do, and this is what Jesus did. We focus on the present. We tend to focus on what's right in front of us, on who people are right now today. But what if we could adopt the approach of Jesus? Pastor John Burke, in a book he wrote called No Perfect People Allowed, has this interesting analogy. He says, if you saw a Rembrandt painting covered in mud, how would you respond? Well, you probably wouldn't focus on the mud. You certainly wouldn't treat the painting like mud. Your primary concern would not be the mud at all, though it would need to be removed. You'd be ecstatic to have something so valuable in your care. But if you tried to clean it up by yourself, do you know anything about cleaning up paintings? I don't. If you tried to clean it up by yourself, you'd probably damage it, maybe destroy it, ruin it. So you take it to a master who knows about that kind of thing. And you'd say, what can you do with this? You let them guide you and help you restore it to the condition that it originally was intended to be in. Burke says this, when people begin treating one another as God's masterpiece, waiting to be revealed, God's grace grows in their lives and cleanses them. Is there someone in your life that you need to view in this way? Rather than focusing on the mud, focus on the masterpiece that's underneath. Maybe be the one to encourage them, to call out the best in them, and start by accepting them where they are, bearing with the things that you don't like. Because yes, Jesus focuses on our potential more than our present, but he also doesn't leave us there. He doesn't leave us where he finds us. You know, the tax collectors and sinners in Mark 2 at Levi's house, he didn't give them a free pass. You know, he didn't excuse their poor choices. He didn't ignore their flaws. On the other hand, you see, he actually refers to them as the sick. Well, he acknowledges they've got their problems for sure. But he offers himself as the answer to the problems. He offers himself as the cure for the sickness. He has come to call them to a new way of life, forgiven and free, full of joy and hope and peace and love. You know, Luke, one of our other gospel writers telling the story of Jesus, gives us a similar account of this story of Levi. But he includes something slightly different in what Jesus says. Jesus says it's not the healthy who need a doctor, but the sick. Mark and Luke say that. Mark says, then recalling what Jesus said, he says, I have come not to call the righteous, but sinners. Luke adds a little phrase at the end. I've not come to call the righteous, but sinners to repentance. There's a big scary church word for you on Christmas Sunday. Repentance. It's bigger and scarier than it should be. I mean, it really just means to make a shift, to make a pivot, to change your mind or to change your direction. I was living this way, I was thinking this way, and now I'm shifting and I'm going in a different direction. I'm thinking differently about this. I'm living differently. This is what Jesus calls his followers to. And history tells us how he transformed Levi. As Levi repented, changed his direction, and ultimately would come to be called Matthew. And would there's a gospel that bears his name in the scriptures. And he would be one of the founders of the church. Of course, acceptance of where he was is where it started. But acceptance doesn't mean you like or approve of everything that someone says or does. But it means being patient. It means taking time. It means building a relationship that gives you license to speak to someone, as it would seem Jesus did with Levi. Wonder if there's someone in your life, you know, a mud-covered Rembrandt painting, and you're concerned about them and you'd like to see change in them, and maybe where it starts is with accepting them as they are, not trying to fix them, but trying to connect them with Jesus, that they might build an authentic relationship with him, and then out of that relationship, he will show them where they need to change. I love this word by author Bill Hull. He says, if I could say one thing to a non-Christian who was searching, If I could say one thing to them, it would be this: follow Jesus, and he will teach you everything you need to know. Just that. Follow Jesus and let him teach you. At the beginning of the sermon, I mentioned my skills as a cook, or my non-skills. And what changed? I didn't tell you what changed. Well, one thing that changed was my openness to it, my willingness to say, I can't cook now, but maybe I could. So that was one thing. It also took the primary cook in the house being willing to give me the opportunity and being willing to be patient and being willing to put up with my dumb questions about, you know, well, which pot do I use? And tell me again for the thousandth time, how much is a clove of garlic? Like, it took my wife, Kim, to coach and to be understanding and to see potential. And in that and lots of other ways, she didn't leave me where she found me. And I'm thankful for that. Now, there's a danger when we think about this topic. You know, when we think about those people out there that need to change, right? The Pharisees saw those people that needed to change. But Jesus has a couple categories of people, and it's different than our usual categories. In verse 17, Jesus compares different groups. He talks about the healthy and the sick, the righteous and the sinners. And I imagine if Jesus were here, he might use air quotes when he's talking about the healthy, when he's talking about the righteous. Because you see, the two different kinds of people are not really the healthy and the sick, the righteous and the sinners. By Jesus' standards, everyone is sick. By Jesus' standards, everyone is unrighteous. And the sickness, the unrighteousness is sin. It's the hijacking of our lives, our rebellion against God, our living selfishly for ourselves, and our tendency to do that all the time rather than for the one who made us. But our tendency was the Pharisees' tendency, and it's ours often as well, is to go hard on everybody else and go easy on ourselves. Back in the 1980s, People magazine published an index of sin rankings. They called it the Sindex. Isn't that fun? And so it was a ranking of how bad people thought sins were. And so among the worst would be the ones you'd expect: murder, rape, abuse, and those kinds of things. Surprisingly high on the list were also parking in a handicap space and cutting in line. But the Sindex revealed that the average person believes that they commit about 4.64 sins a month. One measurement. I don't know what 0.64 of a sin is, you know, but I would make the case that that vastly understates the problem. That we are far guiltier than we realize. You know, there's a prayer of confession in the Book of Common Prayer that reveals, if we dig in, reveals the magnitude of the problem. It goes like this: Most merciful God, we confess that we have sinned against you in thought, word, and deed, by what we have done and by what we have left undone. We have not loved you with our whole heart, and we have not loved our neighbors as ourselves. Now, if you think about all of those words, and I mean, there are a whole lot of ways to sin packaged in those few words, aren't there? And I suspect that if that's our measurement, then 4.64 a month is probably far too small. So who are the two kinds of people? There are those who recognize they are sick and need Jesus to make them well. And there are those who don't recognize the sickness. Still have it, but don't recognize it. I mean, Jesus, when he talks about the healthy and the sick, he's not implying that the Pharisees are the healthy. He's implying that they think they're the healthy. It's certainly dangerous when you think you're healthy, but there's an underlying sickness that you're not aware of. And Jesus calls us to recognize that we are not the healthy, that we all are the sick, that we all are the unrighteous, that we all need what he can do for us. You know, I was part of the tax collector sinner crowd once. And sometimes I still am. Probably the thing that's made the biggest difference in my life is the people along the way who have loved and accepted me where I was, but also saw me as a mud-covered Rembrandt. And then they didn't leave me where I was. They challenged me and stretched me and helped me. And so many of those people, for me, were in the church. And that's probably why I'm a pastor today. Because of those people who, on behalf of Jesus, loved and accepted me until I was someone different than I naturally was on my own. I leave you with this question this morning. How can we be a pursuing hospital church? How can we be that kind of church that pursues people, that doesn't just wait for the tax collectors and the sinners to come, but pursues them? How can we be a place of healing? One commentator said the church is the only group in the world where you have to be unqualified before you can join. What would it take for us to be more of a church like that? Not just for the confident, the outgoing, the likable people, the ones who naturally fit in, but for the unsure, for those who are on the sidelines to be welcomed and encouraged. What would it take for this church to be not just one for those who have it all together, but for those who need to get it together? Not for those who have to find God and become godly before they can come, but they can come in first, find a measure of acceptance, and then begin the process of becoming more. Not the kind of church that is walled off from the world, but one that eats with tax collectors and sinners. Can we become that kind of a church? And I think the answer is, in some ways, we're already trying to be that kind of church, but can we keep growing? Can we become more of that kind of church that is not worried about being infected by sin, more worried about infecting the unholy with holy love, focusing on potential even more than the present, not leaving people where we find them? Can we become even more that kind of a church? At Christmas time, I believe Jesus, who came to pursue, would invite us into that kind of a life. What a privilege and opportunity it is. Would you pray with me? We are so grateful, Jesus, that you came. That you came. Not for the healthy, not for the righteous, but for every one of us who is sick, who is unrighteous, who is a sinner. You have come. And we're grateful. Would you make us the kind of people that you want us to be? Not perfect, not holier than thou, but people deeply aware of our need. And people who can invite others to find what they need in you. May we see you clearly this season, so we can live out of that place. It's in your name, Jesus, we pray it. Amen.